Hi there. We've got a lot we're really excited to tell you about, but I'm going to make this real quick so you can get to the episode. The deep dive is coming up at the end of January. The lineup of speakers is incredible and the range of topics is mind-blowing. You do not want to miss out on the last deep dive ever. Then the beta reader matchup is open once again with the matchups going out early in February. Sign up to kick your creative year off with a bang. Lastly, there's an amazing writer's workbook available, which will make the perfect gift for you or the writer in your life. Head to our website, The Shit About Writing, to find out more.
Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair. All right, welcome back to our part two of our money episode. If I could sing, I would sing that like money, 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 money. That type of song would be our little like theme song for this one. So this is part two. Who knows? Maybe we'll have a part three someday if you guys still have burning questions. But I hope this is a series of episodes that you guys can kind of come back to or bookmark or find a way to save so that you have access to all this good information, because this is one of those super curiosity inducing topics. And we're going to kind of go through a new series of questions on things like advances and royalties and marketing and can writing be a job and business questions and all of that sort of stuff and how agenting works from a financial point of view. If you are listening to this and you haven't listened to part one of our money series, you can go back 2 weeks and you'll see it as our Shooting the Shit bonus episode 2 weeks ago, and you can refer back to it. You don't have to have listened to that episode to enjoy this episode, but if you want to listen to both, that is where we are answering all of your questions about money. And happy new year, everybody. Speaking of money and a happy new year, I think we should. I don't have a coffee in front of me. I just have like my little Stanley mug to cheers everybody with, but happy new year.
Happy new year, the happiest of new years. May it be a wonderful year for everyone, filled with good health and good surprises.
Absolutely. And as you guys know, these episodes come out on Mondays. And if you are a Substack subscriber, you will be getting one of our Tuesday editions, which is one of our subscriber editions, tomorrow. And just a couple things to look out for. Bianca thought it would be fun to share our baby pictures, our co-host baby pictures, for you guys to think about or figure out who is who. So I'm looking forward to you guys, just trying to figure out who is who. Cece, do you think they're going to have trouble figuring it out?
It's going to be the easiest thing ever. Like, this is such, I'm sorry, but this is such a silly idea. Like, the sharing the baby picture is adorable, but like, you're going to know it instantly who's who. No one's going to have even like a shred of doubt. Okay. I promise. It is the most obvious thing in the world. Fine. Yes. Oh my gosh. So hard. Like no, everyone's going to know.
Okay. Well, if you want to see us cute babies, you will see them in the subscriber issue tomorrow. So definitely check those out. Our newsletter crew also put together a compendium of all the Q&As that we've done over the years, which our paid subscribers can now download and refer to at any time. This is like possibly hundreds of hours of content. I'm going to be honest with you guys. So definitely make sure you go check that out.
I'm so excited for that one, because now whenever someone asks me a question, I can go, hi, go look at our compendium of Q&As. I'm going to say that. We also have an excellent essay written by Mickey Yashinsky, author of Adventures of Max Spitzkopf, the Yiddish Sherlock Holmes, about the art of eavesdropping. I'm a big eavesdropper. I have so much fun. Like, I love eating by myself in places because I'm always eavesdropping to people's conversations. And I look like I'm not. I look like I'm busy writing away, but I'm not. I'm listening in. So this sounds exciting to me. And then we have an essay by Taylor Hutton, author of Axe and Grind, about tossing narrative curveballs. I don't know anything about tossing balls, but narrative curveball sounds interesting to me.
There you go. So some fun things to check out in our Substack tomorrow. Okay, well, let's jump back into our money questions now. We've tackled a number of questions already. So again, refer back to those. But I'm going to throw to Cece with another question here. And I'm going to throw to her, for writers early in their careers, what is the biggest misconception about how money actually flows after signing a publishing deal?
I think the biggest misconception might be how much time everything takes. So for example, let's imagine that you get an offer, like you got an agent, yay, agent submitted your project, yay, you got an offer, all the yays, you accept an offer. And then there's the contract negotiation. Let me tell you, that can take a long time. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's fast. Nothing in publishing is fast. But yeah, you get paid, like the first installment of your advance typically gets paid after the contract is signed. Which brings me to probably the second biggest misconception. I have had multiple people, and these, in fairness, these are like publishing newbies, which is fine. We all were publishing newbies at one point or another, be like, oh, my advance. So I get it in advance. Actually, these days, advances are broken up in installments, right? So like first installment when you sign, second installment when you deliver all the edits and changes, and that's accepted. And then third installment when your book is published. But speaking of curveballs from our newsletter, there are publishers, I'm not going to call out names and who started this, Penguin Random House, who started paying in fourths. And sometimes you get an extra, not an extra, but like sometimes this is split up into fourths. And then the fourth installment happens 1 year after publication or when the trade paperback comes out. And I've also heard of people, I've never actually experienced this myself, but I've heard of people trying to get away with fifths. Anyway, what I'm getting at is that the misconception is once you accept an offer, you can count on money coming in. And it takes a long time, you know. And once you start earning royalties, that takes a long time too. Royalty season, it's not like you're making money every month unless you sign with an Amazon imprint, which I'm just getting confused now. So I'll stop talking.
One thing I wanted to add about this in terms of biggest misconceptions, one of the things I find, and Cece's obviously all correct in everything she said, is the concept of delivery and acceptance. So Cece touched on that second payment there, which so the first is on signing. So that means both parties signing, counter signature, getting processed through the system, the money being sent to the agency, agency sends the money to the author. But the second payment is the delivery and acceptance payment. And so people really focus on that first word, delivery. The author's like, hey, I handed in my manuscript, you know, where's my check? Delivery and acceptance. Acceptance means, and the definition of this also varies between publisher, but acceptance means that the publisher has accepted all of the edits. So you've gone back and forth through the full editorial process. Some publishers hold on to this money until the book is like fully transmitted, you know, the copy edits are done, then they send the money. I prefer, obviously, you know, the DNA payment to come when the structural edits are done. I think that's fair. The author has done their part. The copy edits is the publisher's job. Obviously, the author has to approve those, but I don't think acceptance should be on copy edits. I think it should be on the developmental edit. So anyway, but so authors will think, hey, you know, I've delivered my manuscript today. The day of recording is December 17th. You know, I'll get my money in a couple of days. But then again, your editing process can take weeks. It can take months, right? You don't know how much this back and forth is going to take to get to that right manuscript. And the publisher is trying to make you work for it, right? That's why they're holding on to this payment. They want to make sure that you're holding up your end of the bargain. So yeah. So anyway, that delivery and acceptance piece, I find a bit of a misconception because authors sometimes think, oh, I delivered versus is the book accepted?
And we didn't get this question, but what you just said now reminded me of if I had a magic wand and I could wave the magic wand, what is something I would do? Like, I'm not saying this would be the top thing I would do, but something that's always bugged me is how publishers, they keep the advance money and they don't have to put it in escrow where it's earning interest for the author, right? Like they're just keeping the money and they're earning interest on it themselves. And that's always bothered me. And I always wish we could have an escrow situation like that. That would make me so happy. I know it's probably never going to happen because there is not enough bargaining power on the author side to make that happen.
Yeah.
Again, oligopsony. But it's always bugged me. Like always bugged me. I'm like, that money should be an escrow. It should be earning interest for the author.
Yeah, yeah. This is a very valid point. We should have a whole episode of what Cece and I think should be changed in publishing. We should write that down.
That would be a very fun episode. And it would bring me a lot of joy because we would get to like live in our imagination land for a full hour. And that would be wonderful.
I'm writing that right down right now so that we don't forget. I'm writing that down as a future episode idea.
All righty. Let me now pick a question for you. I'm not sure if you can answer this. So I'm reading from the question. I'm not sure if you can answer this because she was a previous client of yours, but can you discuss Taylor Jenkins Reid's $40 million 5-book deal with Simon & Schuster? What does this mean for publishing industry / writers? How much would an agent make on a deal like this? Thank you. So Carly has graciously agreed to address this question.
I totally understand why you're asking this question, of course. So I'm not going to like properly address this question, but I do want to talk about, yes, she was my client for 5 years. We worked together over the course of 5 books and, you know, we still have a working relationship. And one of the reasons that I don't talk about her, I want to talk about maybe why I don't talk about her, because I get requests, I get media requests from very large publications asking me for quotes about her early career. I actually decline them. And the reason is, she is a famous person, you know, and I feel a great deal of like protection and respect for her. And, you know, we don't work together actively on current and future projects, but we actually have a continuing working relationship because of the books that I sold for her and the subrights that the agency continues to sell for her. So we do still have a working relationship. So I feel very protective of her. She is a famous person. So I am not going to talk about her out of respect for her. And yeah, you know, we still kind of work together in that capacity. So that's kind of why I don't talk about her. So I just kind of want to talk about why I don't talk about her. So yeah. Hopefully that I don't know if that answers anybody's questions, but yeah.
I like that. Thank you for sharing that with us.
All right, let's move to a question for Cece. Do you think a 2-book deal is a good financial choice?
Okay, this is where the publishing is institutionalized gambling bit comes in. Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to first start off by saying a lot of writers hear 2-book deal and think that is superior to a 1-book deal. Because 2 is more than 1. I have 2 cookies, not just 1. That is not how it works necessarily. 2 is not necessarily superior to 1 in this context. It is actually one of those situations where, I'm sorry, I feel like we can probably play a drinking game. Every time I say it depends, you guys drink, okay? I'm going to drink water. It depends. It depends because it's important to note that if you do have a 2-book deal, just because you have that in your contract does not mean that the publisher is going to invest in the way that you would want them to in the second book. They, in certain cases, this is rare, but it happens, even sometimes cancel the second book. You don't have to pay back the advance that was given, but they might even cancel it if the first book doesn't sell well, if it doesn't do well, if an issue happens. Again, this is rare. But a lot of people think too, like, I kind of have like a guarantee. And that brings us to the question of, do you want a guarantee? Yes, if you accept a 2-book deal, you are tied to that imprint for 2 books. But that means that, A, you're already pricing your second book. So if your first book does incredibly well, you've already sold your second book for the amount that you've sold it for. Like, you can't leverage that. You can't be like, hey, excuse me, we need more money now. Another piece of this is, if you don't like the working relationship with the publisher for whatever reason, including what happens a lot, the editor might have left, you no longer have the option of going to someone else for that second book. Right? Like, that's something that's also a really important piece. Another thing to consider is you might be someone who like enjoys the stability and the guarantee of a second book. I have heard, not from a client, but from an author who's a lovely, lovely author. She was saying, after my first book came out, I was so terrified because all of a sudden I started like your book becomes a product. It was out in the world. That if I didn't have the contractual obligation to deliver a second book by X date, I wouldn't have written. Right? Like, that's her take on it. So that was something that was very comforting for her. So anyway, my point is, it really depends on the situation. There are situations where I look at a 2-book deal, and I have said this to clients, and I say, hey, I personally don't think a 2-book deal is right in this case for these reasons. These reasons being anything that's super specific to my client. And sometimes I go, this actually makes a lot of sense, a 2-book deal with this publisher, and this is good. And it's always the client's decision. My job is never to decide. It is always to advise, but it is so case specific that it depends. How do you feel, Carly?
Oh, yeah, I'm the same. I mean, often you'll see this more for series anyway, right? Where it's like there's kind of a reason to continue this. And if there's going to be a number of books in the series, then it makes sense to just do larger contracts. So you're not like re-upping these contracts constantly, like just from a logistical point of view. But from a strategic point of view, everything Cece said was correct, right? You want to be able to leverage things when you can, and you never want to get yourself into a situation where you're like, oh, I wish that I had have leveraged this, and so on and so forth. The other thing, I don't think that you mentioned this, Cece, so I'll jump on it, is just like the joint accounting versus separate accounting.
I knew you were going to talk about joint accounting. I was like, Carly's going to talk about joint accounting. 5, 4, 3, 2. And then Carly mentions joint accounting. Such a sexy topic. Such a sexy topic. Like joint accounting.
Oh, can't help myself. Gets me fired up. So joint accounting is when in a 2-book deal or multi-book deal that the bucket of the whole advance refers to all of the titles under that contract. And so you don't don't get royalties until you've earned out the entire lump sum. And it could take one book or two books or three books to kind of get through that lump sum. Separate accounting is when each book is accountable to itself. And so there's an advance, you know, for that one, an advance for the second book and the third book and so on and so forth, so that it feels more equitable, because, you know, you want to make sure if book one does earn out, then it is only responsible for itself. So again, there's lots of different theories and strategies about it. Generally, separate accounting makes more sense for most authors, and I think most agents feel that way. And yeah, so anyway, that kind of comes into play. So some publishers might say, yeah, we'll give you a two-book offer, but it's going to be joint accounting. And then it's like, it's their way of kind of protecting themselves and hedging their own bets, because they're accounting these two projects together. And so they don't have to account them separately, which for them is kind of like mitigating some risk, where, you know, it's really just something, in my opinion, that serves the publisher and not the author.
And I agree with that assessment. It's just, again, one more way in which the publisher is potentially getting like the better end of the deal. So yeah, as agents, we typically fight for there to be separate accounting. I am going to ask a question to Carly, and this is going to be under the agent money bucket. Mm-hmm. Carly, how long after you became an agent did you see your first check from a client book? And how long until it turned into a good salary?
This is a great question. So this requires me kind of mostly going back in my memory, because I do have all of this kind of documented, but I didn't go through my old spreadsheets. But I will just, again, be very frank about my recollection of everything. So I became an agent in 2010. I didn't sell a book until 2011. So that was a whole year of not selling anything. And then when I sold that, then again, I sold one book, and that advance was split up in three parts. And so, you know, again, it took a while to obviously for all that to build up. So when I kind of recount this, again, I don't have the paperwork in front of me, but when I recount these memories, I'm like, okay, I made like $0 year one. I potentially made $0 year two, because like, again, we have to negotiate the contract and then you get that advance. So we're talking like, you know, a small amount. And then the way I recount it is like, okay, then I make 10,000. And then is when the extrapolation starts to happen. I make 10, mm-hmm. then I made 20, then I made 40, then I made 70, and then I made 140. Do you know what I mean? Like, so that's when like the doubling starts to happen. And it honestly doubled for a while. You know, it's that ability to like sell the books. And then I worked on a lot of books that earned royalties, which was a huge help. And so I wasn't just relying on, you know, advances. It was like, okay, when royalty season happened, and generally it's kind of spring and fall, but for each publisher it's slightly different. So then you start to get some cash flow start to happen that will, you know, fill in all of these gaps, and then you start to kind of be able to call it a salary or call it a career, you know, in a way that kind of made sense. But it was a lot of money management of, okay, this is when a lump sum is going to come in, and this has to last until then. And it's really hard in this business to kind of know when payments are ever going to come in, because as I say with like delivery and acceptance, I don't know when the book is going to be accepted, or I don't know when this contract is going to be finished. And so, you know, that learning how to cash flow that at a really early young age, because I've said this before, but I started agenting when I was like 22. I think I had my own list by the time I was 22. So I've just done this from a very young age. And so it taught me a lot of good money management skills.
For sure. For sure. I love that. And I love that. Thank you for sharing. Do you want me to read the next one?
Sure. Yeah. What do we got next?
Okay, so I'm going to read one from Business Questions. How much do you think Penguin spent on getting Anne Hathaway to promote a debut novel yesteryear? I'm not crazy for thinking this is crazy, right? LOL.
Okay, I love this question because this speaks to so many things that I love to talk about. So I think this person saw Anne Hathaway, or, you know, maybe they follow her on social media, and they see, oh my gosh, a celebrity is promoting a book, a novel. What does that mean? What this person doesn't know is that Anne Hathaway is starring in this movie. Right. Yeah. And so as a publishing person, I know this. And so I think, okay, this book hasn't come out yet. What Anne Hathaway is doing as a producer, I believe she's a producer as well. As a producer, she wants this book to do really well, because if this book does really well, then it creates more of a mobilized grassroots fan base. And again, this book is set up to do quite well, but now we have this like grassroots fan base, and oh, Anne Hathaway's talking about this, and we build and build and build. And so this is also a way for Anne Hathaway to provide some insurance on the movie that she's making about this. So that's why you're seeing it. It's not that Penguin paid Anne to do it. Anne actually wants this book to sell a lot of copies, because if it does, then that helps her movie. So I just wanted to, I thought that was a great question, because it just kind of speaks to the inner workings of the behind the scene about how all these things are connected.
It's skin in the game, right? Yeah. Like, it's skin in the game. That's why, like, I, again, this is a totally separate situation, but I still remember my mother-in-law, whom I adore, spending, I think it was Christmas with us here. And she was like, oh my gosh, did you see that Obama is narrating a really cute documentary about the ocean? And isn't that so nice of him to do that? And I was like, Mom, it was actually my husband. My husband was like, Mom, of course it's nice of him to do it. He seems like a really nice guy, but like, he's doing it because he has skin in the game. Like, his production company is the one that produced the documentary. That's the reason. So I think it's really easy for our brains to be like, publishing paid this person X amount of money. And sometimes, yeah, I mean, we've seen some questionable marketing investments. But yeah, I actually remember, this was so much fun, when was this? I'm pretty sure this was in my, I visited Jenny Jackson, the editor of Yesteryear, who's also an author, by the way. If you guys haven't read her book, you should. She was telling me about Yesteryear. She was telling me about like this book that she had upcoming. This was a long time ago. She was so excited about it. And I remember thinking like, oh my God, I really want to read this book, because of the way that she was like so passionate about it. So, you know, remember that like there's always drivers of a book's success that happened even before the Anne Hathaways of the world come into the equation.
Definitely. All right. And with that, we are going to take a break for our sponsors.
Those of you that have been here for a while know I love to update you on my summer vacation travels. So I want you to know we have chosen next year's trip. We are going to Germany and Austria so we can check out the Alps. So we have some learning to do, friends. I need to teach the kids some German too. They're obviously loving their summer Euro trips, and I really hope we can continue it as a family as long as they want to hang out with me forever, right? Right? Our kids are going to want to be our best friends for the rest of their lives. Yes, yes, yes. So imagine how much richer your life could be with travel experiences if you could speak more languages. With Rosetta Stone, you're going to gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you go. Rosetta Stone is the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive methods help you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, wherever and whenever it fits your hectic winter schedule. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, German, yes, German, can't wait, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. Learn faster, retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally, helping you think, communicate with confidence. There's no English translation, so you truly learn to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. It has an intuitive learning process. You start with words, build to phrases, and progress to full sentences. It's designed for long-term retention, so what you learn sticks with you. Learn anytime, anywhere. It fits your lifestyle with flexible on-the-go learning. You can access your lessons from desktop or mobile app, whether you have 5 minutes or an hour, and there's incredible value. You can learn for life. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. The Shit About Writing listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Are you starting a new job, cleaning out last year's don't fit anymore outfits? Do you simply need a wardrobe refresh? Well, Quince has you covered. Luxe essentials that feel effortless and polished. You can layer them, I know I do, and mix and build a wardrobe that lasts. The versatile styles make it easy to reach for them day after day, and I am such a creature of habit that once I like something, I buy it in multiple colors, and that's what I'm doing with my Quince pieces. Quince has all the staples covered. I can't stop talking about the Mongolian cashmere tees, and I will not rest until everyone has one. I've already talked them up to everyone in my life, and I am talking them up to you too. I have three, and I'm wearing them every day. The cashmere sweaters feel like designer pieces but don't have the markup. Then there's the 100% silk tops and skirts for easy dressing up. Now, let's talk Italian wool. The Italian wool coats are beautifully tailored, soft to the touch, and built to be worn for years. Like everything from Quince, each piece is made with premium materials and ethical, trusted factories, and then priced far below other luxury brands. My cashmere sweaters are on constant rotation over here. It's been so cold lately that I've been layering a cashmere sweater tee with a cardigan over top for a lovely, soft, hugged wool feeling. You know when it's cold outside, but you're going somewhere, but you don't exactly know what the temperature is going to be inside? Happens to me all the time. And for that, I've been wearing my sleeveless cashmere sweater. I can layer it, but if I'm too hot, I have the right amount of coverage. It's so cozy while giving my arms some room to breathe. It feels very chic as well. Multiple people in my extended family have bought them because I've been parading them around. I have the oatmeal in two styles, and I have heather gray as well. The colors are very quiet luxury, if you ask me. They have over 8,000 reviews on the website, averaging, wait for it, 5 stars. They have earned every single one, believe me. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/tsnotyah for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/tsnotyah to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/tsnotyah.
Okay. I want to ask Carly a business question from our listeners. How much should a debut author consider spending for marketing / PR support and help?
Oh, this is a good question. So the way that I like to frame this is twofold. I usually say to a client or anybody asking, you know, this advance money is your money. I'm not presuming to know your financial situation. You might need to take that money and pay off debt. You might need to take that money and take a sabbatical from work. You know, it's your funds, basically. But a lot of authors will say, again, what should I do? And so I will try to say, you know, is there a percentage that you think that you can set aside from this to help with these matters? And it could be a percentage of the entire advance. It could be a percentage of a certain section of the advance. Because the other thing is, a lot of these marketing and PR kind of companies, if you're going to hire them, they want to be hired about a year in advance of the book coming out. So you kind of got to think, okay, of this first chunk, the signing part of the money, can I take some of that money? And so generally, these companies charge for a pretty active campaign, let's say kind of like 4 to 6 months. They're probably going to charge anywhere between kind of like $10,000 and $20,000, which is quite a large amount of money. And especially for a lot of authors who maybe are debuts, or they don't know how this industry functions and what this money is supposed to be for, and, you know, how this kind of flows and works. It can obviously feel like a lot of money because it is a lot of money, but you're hiring somebody to do a job. Right? You're hiring somebody. That's kind of the concept. And so some authors will think, oh, can I just take $500 here and throw it there? And I'm like, well, what are we doing with that $500 or $1,000? Right? Because there are, you know, a lot of people who advertise, like, I could do a blog tour for you or all these other things. And you really have to think about what's going to move the needle. So it's not so much a matter of, can I just take some money and do something with it? It's all about having a plan for that. So do you want to hire somebody to do a podcast tour for you? That's an active thing where it's like, oh, I want to do a podcast tour. These are the companies that can get me on podcasts. Or I want to do a speaking tour, right? It's like, I just think it's really important to have a real strong focus on what you want to do. Or this company has a great reputation for serious nonfiction, getting in more literary magazines. Okay, that's what I want. So to me, it's not so much like, I have some money, what do I do with it? It's, what is my plan? What are some gaps? What are some opportunities? And what is the amount of money that stuff like that costs? And I'll be honest with you, it's quite a bit of money. So to do with that what you will, but remember, you only launch your debut once. So just have really active conversations with your agent and your publisher about what potentially some of those gaps might be. And if you want to fill those or supplement those and work together as a team, because that's the thing, y'all want to be rowing in the same direction, especially if you're hiring a third party.
100%. I think that, I don't know, I kind of want to touch on this, and it's not a fun thing to say. For anyone who is able to think of the advance money as money that you will reinvest into the business you've created, that is a good thing. It doesn't mean any guarantees. It's really important to understand that, but that is a good thing. And if anyone's listening to this and thinking, CC, that sounds super unfair, because that means that people with financial privilege have a leg up. That is exactly what it means. In this capitalist society, having that financial privilege can often give you a leg up in many instances. Everything from, you have money to, I don't know, hire meal prep services so you can have more time to write, to this big thing. Like, financial privilege affects every single aspect of being an author, and oftentimes does lead to more success because you are able to buy back your time, because you're able to invest in PR, because you're able to invest in many, many ways. And that is so unfair. And it's also so reality, you know, like, this is reality, and not talking about it doesn't help. So if you are able to look at your advance as money that you are going to use to invest in your business, if you are able to do that, it's it's something that is advisable, I would say, in general.
All right. Next question I want to throw to Cece because it's kind of fun. We can both answer it. This person said, am I being delusional for so fully believing my story has $1 million potential? I'm a marketing strategist, so I look at everything as investment / performance / audience opportunity. But the negative stories on author monies are making me wonder if I'm being too optimistic in this world or scarce chance.
Are you being delusional? I think this depends on what you mean by $1 million potential. If you think about it, every book has $1 million potential. Like every book could earn the author $1 million. Every book could earn $1 million to the publisher. Every book could, right? It just depends on whether readers will respond to that in that way. And that is not a meritocracy. So much of it is discoverability. So if you're thinking it has potential, no, you're not being delusional because every book does and your book is a book. If you're thinking I will for sure make $1 million off this story really fast, then most likely, yes, you are being delusional, though it's possible you're not, but most likely, yes, you are. I think that it's important to remember that in life, like you would never go into a new job, right? Without first studying what salaries are paid. You want to be an accountant. You want to be, archaeologist. Like you would research, what do most people make? What is the average salary? Like what companies are hiring? What's the job market like? You would research all these things. And so a huge thing that authors need to do is kind of research, like, hey, are most authors able to work to make a living off their books if they have one or two books? No, most authors are not. Some are, but most are not. And so if by that you mean like for sure, then yes, delusional. And if by that you mean it could happen, then no, not delusional. I will add though, like I have seen delusional people skyrocket because fortune favors the bold. Let's just be honest, you know, like I have seen delusional people achieve so much success in their lives. And I have seen delusional people really crash and burn and not be successful at all because fortune favors the bold, but so does failure. Failure also favors the bold. It can go either way. I genuinely think that it depends on whether you're able to look at your own talent. You're able to understand how the marketplace works. You're able to understand the hard work that goes into it. It is not a stable career. I'm telling you right now, stability, no, it's not. But it is a career with million potential for sure.
One thing I also want to talk about is this idea of like $1 million potential, because you could mean $1 million. Like I think this person's alluding to the idea of like, is this $1 million deal? But they said $1 million potential. And so there are a lot of books that earn $1 million in their lifetime, because books can be around for a very long time. And if they're a steady seller that sell year on year, and they kind of like, you know, come up with different trends, it's something that's not necessarily topical, that's evergreen. There's a lot of books that earn $1 million over the course of their lifetime, or even authors that, you know, earn $1 million over their lifetime. So I think this person means like $1 million advance, but yeah, it's totally possible to work on $1 million ideas. Both of us work on $1 million ideas all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what makes our job so exciting. I mean, it's part of what makes our job so exciting. Okay. Question that I'm going to throw to Carly and we'll both talk about. Do advances trend based on genre / popularity?
All right. So these are kind of two separate things. Genre and popularity are obviously different. But I think what this question is probably trying to get at is, do advances trend, right? Like what are the things that make advances trend, or what are some more popular buckets than others and that sort of thing. So yes, advances do depend on genre and popularity, and sometimes the combination of the two. Generally, what advances depend on the most is competition, right? And so I think the heart of it is competition, because with an advanced situation for a debut, right? So if we're potentially going to sell something and there's a lot of interest for it, then that you know, drives up the interest for it and kind of drives up the advance based on the market conditions. So yes, I would say advances trend based on genre and popularity. Another way to think of it is, you know, again, categories that are doing really well, publishers want to kind of continue to invest in those because that's a diversification of their allotment of all of their different imprints. And they're going to focus on the things to reinvest in the imprints that are continuing to do well. So there's that like imprint investment. Advances do depend on so many things, and also authors and where they're at in their career, right? If somebody is kind of proving book on book that they are continuing to sell a lot of copies and kind of, again, rise in that category, then yeah, that advance is going to trend up. So it makes a lot of sense, you know, and I think this person knows that, right? That if somebody is selling a lot of copies, they're going to get a higher advance. If a category is moving a lot of copies, it's going to get a higher advance because that's where the market concentration is.
Yeah. I also think it's important to note, because this is a really interesting discussion, that because of the subjective nature of publishing, and that includes how subjectively publishers can see the positioning of a book, advances can vary widely in an auction. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes you see that all the publishers see that book positioned in the same way. But, you know, we've all agents have been involved in auction situations where you get one offer for 300, another offer for 350, another offer for 370, and then one offer for $50,000. And you're like, this person's out to lunch, you know? And I've also seen situations where it's like everyone in the same level and then one person offering like hundreds of thousands more, you know, like it does vary. And part of what, you know, the publisher's job at the end of the day, and this is not a secret, I'm not spilling industry secrets here, but it's to protect the publisher, right? Like editors love authors, and I'm so grateful for editors, but editors are like one person within a big, big institutional machine. Their job is to offer as much money as they think they can offer to get you. They don't want to overpay you. That is not in their best interest. Why would it be? You know, like if they can get a book for less money, that's a good thing for them. I still remember was this last year? No, it wasn't. So Simon & Schuster had like a virtual roundtable around my birthday. So it was in June and it was via Zoom. And I had to catch up the recording because it actually happened. I'm pretty sure it was during the day of Bianca's launch, which is why I couldn't watch live. Mm-hmm. Okay. But, yep. You know, one of the things they talked about is how much they love their backlist that they didn't pay a lot for, you know, and they talk about this openly, not in a mean way, but they talk about, hey, it's really great when we can buy a book for not very much money. And that book does really well and makes everyone money, us, the author, et cetera. So remember, when you're looking at advances, advances do vary, but one of the variables is actually how a publisher sees it, you know, like how do they see that as a lead title? Do they see this as a X or Y, a Z? Like that also influences it a lot.
All right, guys. Well, we hope we kind of covered as many of the hot topics that you wanted to cover. Those were the buckets of questions that came in. That was what was asked. We really enjoyed this topic. So maybe we'll do a part three in the future. But that's kind of our wrap for today. So we're so excited to kick off 2026 with you guys and lots of more shooting the shit topics to come. I wrote down a number of ideas based on some of the spinoff conversations that we've had today. So thank you guys for tuning in.
Thank you. Bye.
CC Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query CC, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. Hi there. We've got a lot we're really excited to tell you about, but I'm going to make this real quick so you can get to the episode. The deep dive is coming up at the end of January. The lineup of speakers is incredible and the range of topics is mind-blowing. You do not want to miss out on the last deep dive ever. Then the beta reader matchup is open once again with the matchups going out early in February. Sign up to kick your creative year off with a bang. Lastly, there's an amazing writer's workbook available, which will make the perfect gift for you or the writer in your life. Head to our website, The Shit About Writing, to find out more.